Hello, I am Grace Lloyd. I'm from Colorado State University. And a lot of you are probably about to boo me off the stage to think about removing residues from drylands, but I hope you'll bear with me on this. The Department of Energy has set a goal that by 2030, 1 billion tons of biomass would be available. This would be the amount needed to supplant about 30% of our current petroleum fuel usage. And they've basically targeted agricultural residues as attractive near-term feedstocks, namely because they're already produced as co-products in our current agricultural system and do not require any expansion of agricultural land. And the big debate right now is, yes, they're available, but what will this cost the future productivity of the soil and the land? And will we see decreases in yields if we start to remove residues? I don't think I even need to talk about these things. This is a room full of people working in dryland systems. I've put just a few of the roles of crop residues down here: mitigation of wind and water erosion, conservation of soil water, both increasing the efficiency of fallow and mitigating, increasing infiltration rates. They're also a direct source of crop nutrients, so removing residues is going to require increases in fertilizers. And the hot topic right now, soil organic carbon and the role that residues play in that cycle. So I think there's been a lot of great research going on trying to understand the role of residues and what the implications of removal will be before the infrastructure and demand for feedstocks develop. So I think that we should be grateful for that. I think there's been a lot of great work done in the Midwest, John Sheehan, particularly Nelson and others. They've looked at what sustainable stover removal rates would be, well, what the tolerable levels would be to still, to not risk erosion by wind and water, but they haven't looked at soil organic carbon. And removal rates are undoubtedly region specific. We all know that. And what's okay in the Midwest is not going to be okay in dryland environments. So no one has looked at what the potential for moving stover is in dryland agricultural systems. And they're probably correct in doing that. But environmentally sensitive regions, such as the semi-arid Great Plains, require very different management practices to maintain sustainability in more humid regions of the country. This is a historic picture of farmland in the semi-arid Great Plains, and you can see the sand there, obviously a very sensitive system. And the reason I think it's important for us to understand the real science and the arguments behind this topic is that if cellulosic biofuels does take off, there will undoubtedly be some demand or pressure for residues to be harvested from these environments. It is important for farmers to understand ahead of time what this will really mean for the productivity of their systems. So we need to establish or answer a few questions. First of all, what is the biomass production potential? What's the baseline? Perhaps there's not enough to even make it economically viable. And if that's the case, then we rest our case there. But if there is enough, what would be the implications of harvesting that residue? One other reason why I think it's important to look at dryland systems, there's been a lot of criticism recently in the life cycle analysis that is being done on biofuels concerning the amount of water that's required to produce them. And the proportion of irrigation water going to biofuel production is projected to jump from about 3% in 2005 to 20% in 2030. And a timely science article came out. I'll read this quote. "The potential for irrigation shortages is greatest in the Western Plains states, where average rainfall isn't sufficient to grow corn and biofuel production is increasing." So our objectives were to quantify long-term annual biomass production levels for corn, wheat, and millet in semi-arid no-till systems, and attempt to report variability in production due to climate, soil type, and annual fluctuations in precipitation. This last point, you all know how, well, if we're not irrigating, we're dependent on precipitation for our yields. So how much variability is there from year to year? A little background to the site. In 1985, experiment was initiated at three sites in eastern Colorado. All sites are non-irrigated and were converted to no-till. And the focus was long-term dynamics of cropping intensity on production, soil properties, both chemical and physical, and also water use efficiency. And this is a picture of one of the sites I took this summer, and we were drilling soil samples. The few variables that are involved are climate, soil, and also cropping system variable. As far as the climate goes, you can see the three sites there, Sterling at the northern position and Walsh in the south. Precipitation and temperature levels are similar among all three sites. They do increase in the potential evaporation potential from north to south. So Walsh has a water deficit that's greater than that at Sterling. Each site has a soil variable. It's laid across the soil catena. And the properties vary by soil position. And you will see the impacts of soil position on production very shortly. The cropping system variable for this report is basically held constant. We're looking at a wheat corn fallow and a wheat millet fallow. Focusing in briefly on the amount of organic carbon by soil position, the three sites are along the left, Sterling, Stratton, and Walsh. And you can see that the summit position at Sterling, organic carbon is 9.8 grams per kilogram, and at the toe, 14.59. Stratton has an even more startling increase at the toe of 19.21. In Walsh, we obviously have lower levels altogether, but you still have about a threefold increase between the summit and the toe position. I think it's important to realize that within one site, there's that much variability. So our methods, each year biomass yields were estimated by hand sampling, basically whatever grad student was available. This summer it was me. We took those samples back to the lab and oven dried them, weighed them, and separated into stover and grain components. And we also obtained grain yields on the entire plots using a combine. And the reported biomass values were obtained by dividing grain yields from the combine by the harvest index in the hand-collected biomass sample. So a few results. This is the species variation in biomass production averaged over all sites and soil positions. So as you can see, the species effect, wheat surprised us by having the highest long-term yields. This is probably because it's a drought avoider and has a winter growing habit and is not as affected by periods of drought. Millet, not a very strong performer. Corn, I don't know, that's probably typical for the region. If you look at both average stover and average grain together, you might have a semblance of what an actual, if you're going for total biomass of a crop, you might be able to get, 6,000 kilograms per hectare per year. It should be noted, though, these are obviously not biomass crops. These are grain crops, and you could probably get much higher yields from something that was bred to just for biomass and wasn't trying to put on grain. So this surprised me how little this is compared to the Midwest. The Midwest, the last 5 years, their average for grain in the top five corn-producing states is about 10,000 kilograms per hectare, and that's just the corn grain. So if you assume a one-to-one stover-to-grain ratio, you might have 10,000 kilograms per hectare of residue available from those systems. This is the amount of residue which was estimated was needed to maintain a 33% fallow efficiency in Colorado. So you need about 6,100 kilograms per hectare of residue to have that sort of fallow efficiency. So if we decide to harvest residues, from wheat, for example, we might see subsequent declines in yields because we have less stored soil moisture. In terms of soil organic carbon, this is from an estimate of Wilhelm working in the Midwest. It was what he gave as an estimate needed to maintain soil organic carbon in a no-till system that was corn and soybean. This was the most comparable thing that I could find to our system, and we're nowhere near that. A question for future work would be, is that how much we would need to maintain soil organic carbon? I think that's a different question. I think we have lower initial levels and probably different dynamics in the soil organic carbon pool. Climatic differences, not incredibly severe. Walsh, you can see the result of basically less precipitation and more evapotranspiration. But all three sites, for eastern Colorado, you're not going to get much more than 5,500 kilograms per hectare of total biomass. And this is the most interesting slide to me, because you can see the variation between sites and also at just one site. On the left, I've averaged the total corn biomass production by soil position across all three sites. And you can see the tow has a startlingly larger amount of biomass production. And at Stratton on the right, the production at the tow is even greater. And I put this in here mainly to point out that the variation between a site should really be focused on, because a farmer might, you know, have a specific portion of his field where he gets great yields on, and therefore decides, oh, I could harvest some residues. But if you average it over the whole site, you may not be able to take anything at all. Also, if you found the right soil with a high water holding capacity and actually used a biomass crop, you might be able to get 9,000 kilograms per hectare per year, but you'd really have to seek out that soil. The variation over time, from 1986 to 2008, I plotted all the yields of corn averaged over all slopes and sites. And I put this in here to show you the variability, which most of you are very familiar with, because we're not irrigating. We're completely dependent on precipitation. And in 1994, we have a total biomass yield of 7,000 kilograms per hectare. And if a farmer decided in that year, you know, say he was strapped for cash and decided to sell some of his residues, 1995 comes along, which is a year of drought. That might be when he needs his residues the most. And if he's already sold them, it could have severe consequences in terms of erosion, even further reduced yields, et cetera. So also the biomass feedstock buyers need a consistent source of feedstocks. So if people working in the arid, semi-arid Great Plains have this sort of variability in yield, it's going to be hard for the processors to get a continuous supply and a reliable supply. My summary and conclusions: our biomass production levels are much lower than those in the Corn Belt. We have large variations due to climate and soil position in our yields. Also, our variations in precipitation result in large annual fluctuations in yields, which might be hard to provide a continual source of feedstock or reliable source. Our biomass production levels are well below the levels recommended for efficient water storage during fallow, maintaining soil organic carbon, and also for controlling erosion. Just a note, the crops we examined are obviously grain crops. They're not biomass crops. But it is possible that if we had a drought-resistant biomass crop grown in the right soil, we could achieve much higher levels of biomass production. So I think that's something which people need to examine, because if we're not irrigating these systems and water is a real issue for the life cycle analysis of biomass crops, I hope someone can start to look at the potential for other crops that are specifically biofuels crops. And that's all.